Hello, and welcome to It's Lit, where all things literary live at the root. I'm Aisha Kai, managing editor of The Glow Up, and today we are talking with the very talented Kylie Reid, author of Such a Fun Age. Kylie's debut novel was a runaway hit of 2020. It was an instant New York Times bestseller and was named Best Book of the Year by numerous publications, including NPR, The Washington Post, Kirkus Reviews, Slate, Elle, and my hometown paper, The Chicago Tribune. It's also been optioned by Emmy-winning actress, producer, and screenwriter Lena Waithe's Helm & Grad Productions and Sight Unseen Pictures. And I, for one, cannot wait to see it. I had so much fun talking to Kylie. She's someone who I've been trying to get on the podcast for quite some time, so it was thrilling to finally get to sit down with her thanks to the spring launch of the paperback of Such a Fun Age. We talked about how this book came to be and her approach to crafting a compelling story, her writing style, and so much more. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. Let's get to it. Kylie, welcome to It's Lit.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat.
I'm excited to chat with you today because this is like super cool for me. I have a lot of questions about Such a Fun Age, but before we dig into this seriously fun read, because I think this was a really fun read for me.
Oh, good.
We have a ritual here at It's Lit. We built this podcast to be about Black books, Black writers, Black journalists, thought leaders. And we like to start every episode by asking our guests to name at least one book or books, if you can't just name one, that has been life-changing, groundbreaking, mind-blowing for you. Like, was there a specific book that just broke you wide open as a writer or a reader?
Okay. I mean, you know, I did my homework.
I'm ready. No, I love it. I love it. See, that's what I'm talking
about. I
could
even do a show and tell for you. I like have them here ready and waiting.
I should tell our readers, I'm looking at Kylie and there's like a whole bookshelf, like a whole wall of books. So.
Yeah. Okay. I couldn't pick just one. So that's I'm going to do one nonfiction, which is this one here, Black Liberation and Socialism by Ahmed Shaki. I felt that, you know, you ever realize like you're looking for something that you don't even know what you're looking for?
And all the time.
Yes. And this one was something I was looking for in terms of probably coming off of talking about this novel too. Mm-hmm. I was looking for someone, an expert to help me understand racism as a materially connected to capitalism, understanding racism through the history of labor, specifically, you know, sugar, tobacco, rice. And what's the other one? I can't remember. There's another.
There is another. I mean, yeah, sugar, tobacco, rice, cotton.
Yes, that's what.
But
how can I forget cotton?
Also domestic labor, which you get into.
Absolutely. It was a really great read and just one of those reads that you can't stop underlining everything and understanding, you know, white supremacy coming up along with capitalism and labor and not separate from it. It was really, really wonderful. And so that was one that this year I read that was really great. And then this one, okay, I'm late. Everyone's like, we know. I'm like, guys, this is really good. It's Salvage the Bones by Jesmyn Ward. Knocked me out.
You're not late. You know, I think you're only the second person who said that on the podcast. I think the first was Jason Reynolds. So you're in great company.
Yes.
Yes. You know, and I'm late as well, because as much as I love books, I can't read everything all the time. I am obsessed with Jesmyn Ward in general. And I'm low-key obsessed with you, so don't be freaked out. When you talk about a book that, I don't know, that you felt like you needed to read, this was a book for me. You know,
that makes me really happy. That's awesome.
No, it was fun. You know, Michaela knows this. I've been talking about getting you on the podcast. We started the podcast way after you published this book. So I wasn't sure if we would, you know, get you on here, but I have been talking about you since the beginning. So I was really excited. And I should note that the book just came out on paperback.
It did.
Y'all can get that version. If you want something bendable that you can put in your bag, go ahead. Mm-hmm. So I just want to say that. But, you know, and I'm sure you've had time now to get acclimated to your success, which has included several accolades and award nominations. And I don't know, an acquisition by Lena Waithe and Helm & Grad Productions. And there's things happening in Sight Unseen Pictures. There are things happening for you, which congratulations on all of that.
Thank you.
And I'm excited to see how this translates to the screen as well. But
I have to just ask, you know, straight up, like, what was your initial vision for this novel? Like, how did this originate for you?
You know, it always starts with people. It's the people who really, really get me hooked into something. And coming out of it, you know, people always say, like, you know, what made you want to write about race? And I personally feel like you cannot theme your way into a plot. It has to be the other way around, and you have to start with people. So for me, I love very low to the ground, domestic, almost petty instances that you walk away being like, why did she say that? What does she mean? But I love those moments. And I also think that 3 is such a magical fiction number. So I just knew that I wanted a young woman who's figuring out her life, her boss, and her boyfriend. That's really what I knew that I wanted. And I got lucky in that translated into a more interesting 3-way relationship, which was a young Black woman, the white child she takes care of, and the mother of the child. So that was it. I just wanted an awkward 3-way thing. That was the beginning.
It was wonderfully awkward. And I, you know, Michaela already knows this about me, our producer, Michaela, for our readers, our listeners, I should say. I have woo-child moments. And in this book, so I think, I say whenever I get verbal with a book, that's a good thing. Like I sat there reading your book and I was so verbal. I was like, oh no. Oh, hell no. Oh God.
I love that so much. There was a minute where a lot of people were tagging their pets' faces when they would go, and their pet would look at them when they were reading the novel, which I love. So yes, a verbal read is the
goal. There were audible gasps. And I felt like, you know, in a weird way, it's like that it's like the literary version of like Black people in the movie theater. Yes. You know, we're like, girl, don't do it. Don't go in there. Like, no, yes. Run.
They can't hear you, but they hear you.
But they do hear me. They heard me. So I want to talk about the title for a minute because you just talked about 3 being a magical number and 3 comes up, obviously, in the littlest heroine of this book. Mm-hmm. Who was a 3-year-old child. I know, little Briar. But, you know, this title seems so multi-layered to me, and I just had to ask just flat out. I mean, it's a simple question, but what does the title Such a Fun Age mean to you?
Absolutely. You know, on a really basic level, this is just a little penchant of mine. I love when the title isn't in the book for some reason. Mm-hmm. I love when it stands on its own and kind of puts an umbrella over the whole thing.
I looked for it. I was like, where is it?
Everyone's like, wait, where is this thing? I'm like, you ain't gonna find it. So stop looking. I love that when it's not in a book for some reason. But you know, the first thing was I'm really interested in transactional relationships, mm-hmm. especially those that happen inside the house, because this person's in your house all day, but they are a stranger, especially if you have your boundaries set up. So Such a Fun Age is something that I heard often when I was babysitting between strangers on a playground. It was always, oh, he's so cute. Oh, how old is he? Oh, it's such a fun age. Yeah. And it was just like asking about the weather. It was a very just trite thing to say between people. So I love that it put you in a toddler and a stranger place at first. But also I love adding a clock onto a story. And for Amira, her 26th birthday is this constant timer of like, hey, you need to figure out what's going on with your healthcare because of the country we live in. So you got to figure it out. But even bigger, this is based in 2015. And there was a very big move to romanticize the time before the 2016 presidential election and saying, oh, things were so good. Things are terrible now. And that's not exactly true. Black Lives Matter started making themselves really known in 2014 and 15, but also, you know, in the 50s, most women were domestic care workers. And so I wanted it to comment on the bigger age and almost as, you know, as if nothing has changed in certain scenarios, except for now we're just texting and looking at things online instead.
Well, I mean, first of all, that's brilliant and I love it. And second, you know, thank you for making that nod. You know, when there's so many references here and I'm going to double back to that. But one of them that was writ really strong for me is this definite history of Black women's domestic labor in the United States in particular. Like my own great grandmother was a domestic, you know, I'm a former teacher. My mother's a former teacher. You know, I think that while that doesn't take place in the home, there is this juxtaposition, right, of Black women being tasked with caring for predominantly white children in a very specific way. And I think that you did something really masterful with the nuances of that here. And as one of your characters, I'm not even sure he's one of the more woke characters, but one of your characters, Kelly, he's endearing, but that, and that, see, even that, the nuances, you made these people so complex. It's like, I love you. I hate you. I love you. I hate you. You know, right? But as Kelly notes, there's a lot to unpack here. And you delve into not just race, but it's also about class. It's about respectability politics. It's about generational politics. It's about police intimidation. And I don't think it's wrong, or, and I certainly hope not insulting to say this was ambitious, and you pulled it off, right?
Fantastic. Yeah.
So did this unfold organically for you? Like, or were you just like adding layers? You know, you said you didn't deliberately set out to write a book about race, mm-hmm. but how did this unfold for you as a narrative?
I think, you know, I think many writers, the first, you know, initial phases is thinking about writing the book for like a year.
Just like, yeah, I can personally attest to this, or two.
Yep. Yep.
Three,
that part is
five,
important too.
I don't know.
You need to do whatever is good for you. I definitely sat on it for about a year. And then I was living in New York City, and I had just gotten a huge round of 9 rejections to graduate school. Mm. And my then boyfriend, now husband, said, you know, I have a job opportunity in Arkansas. Do you want to move with me and write your butt off and see what happens? I was like, let's do it. Let's change it up. I moved to Arkansas, and that's where I really put pen to paper. So I started writing it there, but I do remember. Okay. So from there, I went to graduate school, and that's where I finished it. But that was New York to Arkansas to Iowa. And I remember being in very specific place in all 3 states where I thought, this is not going to work. This is just not going to pan out the way I want it to. And I'm so glad it did. But I think that that doubt is very normal, especially with something that's super plot driven. You really have to figure out all of those twists and turns while making characters nuanced but familiar, and making them, you know, go along with the rules that you've set up. And so I would say, you know, a lot of other authors spend years and years. I only spent 3 years on this, but there were definitely moments where I was like, this ain't it, but I'm glad it was.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara especially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
I want to zone in a little more on craft, actually, since you attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop. One of the things that really, and maybe you had this talent before, which is why I wanted to ask this question, because something that intrigued me repeatedly while I was reading this book and revisiting it, you have a very unique skill. I think it's unique, and I read a lot of books. you have a way of, and we talk, you've mentioned nuance, I've mentioned nuance, but you specifically have a way of capturing like facial expressions and little like physical tics and gestures that make these characters so real and so specific and so recognizable, right? And I was like, wow. Like, do you think that's a technique you developed, or was that a natural instinct there?
Okay. I'm really glad you say that, because I feel like it makes the way that I write like worth it. Like, cause I'm doing those facial things while I'm writing, and I look crazy.
And I look crazy reading
it. I just, you have to do those little things to make sure that that's what that is. And I think that at Iowa, I started to trust myself a little bit more. I had a really wonderful teacher, Paul Harding, author of Tinkers, Pulitzer Prize winner. He was amazing. And I remember writing that one of Amira's friends, when she's saying thank you, that she's pouting and saying thank you. And Paul said, that is what that emotion is. And that is what that face looks like. It doesn't make sense that she's pouting, but that's what you do in that moment. Follow that instinct and just write it how you see it. And so I think that certain teachers really gave me the confidence to just write things as they are and do those weird facial tics as you're writing to make sure that you're getting it right. But I did go to undergraduate school for theater. And so I've always been really interested in what faces are doing. I know. I cheated.
I mean, I'm you can probably tell just because of how I am, but I'm also a former theater kid. So that makes total
sense to me. I
really
think that former theater kids like lend themselves to novels very nicely. So I'm very excited to read whatever you put out.
We get characters. And it's so interesting because I found myself during the book, and I think it is the former actress in me, was sitting there and I was like mimicking the facial expressions that you were describing. Like, is that? And I'm like, oh my God. And every single time it was dead on. I was like, that is exactly what you do. And so I was
how I read too. Like, especially because I'm like, Kylie, you are not auditioning for this part. Like, stop doing
this. Right. Exactly. Exactly. But in my mind, I am. But I was also just sitting there like, wow, like she really nailed this. Like, there's something.
Yeah.
There was something that I had not seen before in terms of this specific physicality of these characters. And I think it's fair to say for people who haven't read the book, and you all should. And it's an easy read. Like, you know, it's such a, like I said, it's such a fun read as well as such a fun age. It's not, and I don't mean, when I say it's an easy read, I don't even mean it's a simple read. It just was easy. It was like a clean, easy, fun read, right? And I did find myself, I think it's fair to say to our listeners that the plot is actually fairly condensed. This is not like a huge sprawling, like epic.
No, I think it's like 4 months. It's pretty condensed.
Yeah. I mean, 4 months, but also like 15 years, but it's still, but it's still tight. It's really beautifully tight. And I really admired that here. But I mean, and I'm sure I'm not the first one to say this, and I hope you will not be at all offended because I mean it in
a deeply
affectionate way. Obviously, this book like brought up some very specific like reference points for me. Like, I'm like, oh, this is like The Nanny Diaries, but with like the most of the nannies that you actually see. Or it's like The Help, if The Help was centered in their own story, right? Like, so I was sitting there.
You are not the first.
I knew I wasn't. I was like, I can't possibly be the first person who says this. And I didn't think that was necessarily your intention, but I actually loved it for that because I felt like it reconciled a lot of the problematic aspects of those two books while introducing new problems. Because there are new problems.
You know, with this book in particular, the fact that you see references is wonderful to me. With this one, I really wanted to build off of a lot of stereotypes that we've seen and then bend and twist them a little bit. And so, you know, you see that in Kelly is a straight white man and Amira is this young Black babysitter. And then in their friend groups, Alex and Amira have the same different stereotypes in their friend groups. It's the momish friend, the tell it like it is friend. And then I was very excited to play with the magical Negro character we've seen so much of and the sassy best friend that you see in movies as well.
Yes.
And so, you know, picking up this book, it's been such a funny, interesting ride of people saying like, oh, I need to read this book. I need to do the work. I need to do the thing. And then they leave like quoting Tamara. I'm like, girl, you can't just
listen to the Black people in this novel.
Because that's not how it works. So yes, the fact that you were seeing those references was definitely intentional. And I think that makes it a tight read as well.
I love that you brought up Tamara because, you know, sometimes it be your own people. Sometimes. All skin folk ain't kin folk. But, you know, that actually brings me to my next question because, you know, I think it's very easy to walk away from this book and be like, hell hath no fury like a white woman scorned. Like, you could just talk about all the Karens and the white women's problems and white people's problems. But, like, was there a villain for you in this book? Because I have my own thoughts about that. But did you have a villain in mind when you wrote
this? I mean, okay, so here's the thing. You know, this is a novel about people freaking out about their manners, how they're viewed, what they say, how they say it. And as a reader,
intimacy. I love to read They're freaking out about intimacy, which is like hard. And especially
privacy.
Now, it like really strikes home intimacy. What does that mean anymore?
Absolutely. And, you know, as a reader, I love watching people, you know, expel real human behavior and freak out about these little moments because I do that too. As a writer of this, the villain is the fact that Amira can't go to the doctor. Like, that is the villain in this book because in the first chapter, you know, Amira faces this really, you know, racially driven incident, but for the rest of it, she doesn't have healthcare. And that's, you know, that stems from systemic racism as well. And I am more afraid of Alex doing the right thing and giving Amira healthcare, but then having a mercurial personality and being able to take it away from her. Alex having that power, I think, is more of a villain in the story. And so this is not a cop-out, but I mean, the fact that Amira can't, you know, go to the doctor when she's sick, that is the real villain in the story.
Well, I mean, you wrote this before we knew how crucial that would become, right? Like this book came out in hardcover in December of 2019. Obviously, within 4 months, our lives changed dramatically.
Yeah.
And the concept of healthcare has meant something so totally different in the past year. Sure, you can get a vaccine shot for free if you survived to get a vaccine shot, right?
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
And oh, that really, you know, it's so funny because I was thinking of another thing that you did here. You know, as you noted earlier, you set this in like 2015 and 2015 going to 16. And as you said, this was not like, we're not just seeing the genesis of the Black Lives Matter movement now. We're seeing actually the regeneration of the Black Lives Matter movement that mm-hmm. we saw start 7 years ago that has been going since Trayvon Martin and
yes.
so many others since that, just one after another. And this concurrent, like, you know, this like just concurrent trauma and consistent trauma, excuse me. But, you know, this is a book that starts with capturing a racist encounter on video. I think it's worth noting that you and I are speaking literally days after the Chauvin verdict was handed down. And this is a case we know, and I'm a Minneapolis native, so you know I took this personally. Mm-hmm. This is a verdict that we know would never have been convicted if it had not been caught on video. Like, there was a mm-hmm. whole different narrative never. Being floated. Like, how does that sit with you now, like, in terms of, like, I mean, we're still going through this, obviously. We mm-hmm. had trauma that same day. So how does it sit with you in terms of, like, being part of, while I know that wasn't your intention, about being part of that history and that narrative as well, in terms of this now being part of our collective consciousness, that you mm-hmm. have to, if you don't tape it, it didn't happen, right?
Right, right. I think that that's a really great question. Oh, man, there's so many things. Do I have time?
You have time. You have time, yes.
you know, so many Black authors and artists had to contend with the fact that last year and still this year, that what brings people to their art are horrendous murders. And as an artist, I feel you do not get to choose how people come to your art. And I don't think you should be picky about that either. And I think it's a very human emotion to say, I'm panicking. What do I do? How do I, let me read a book. That's beautiful. At the same time, Black authors such as myself have to contend with the fact that your book is playing a role in what is a lie that is presented, that consumption can just cure racism. And that's just not true. You cannot consume your way out of a racist, you know, environment and system. And so it's difficult to sometimes see your book as a balm for people, especially when you didn't create it to tell white people something or teach them something. You know, I think you can learn from novels for sure. But, you know, when I'm a teacher, when I'm in my classroom, that's when I'm a teacher. When I'm writing, I'm a storyteller. And I think that when you're looking at a piece of art, you know, imagine going to a museum and looking at a picture and being like, oh, make me good. Like, teach me how to be. That's not how you enjoy art. And so I think that a lot of Black authors are contending with the fact that people aren't enjoying their art the way that they once thought they would. That being said, you know, I've done a lot of interviews for this novel and I've been so, so bowled over by the response. And I understand that interviewers have a job. They try to wrap things up very, very nicely at the end and say, you know, tell us about the hope that you have. And I'm trying so, so hard to be really honest and say that at a certain point, it's unfair to ask Black people to talk about their hope. Mm-hmm. You know, when we see issues like this come over and over and over again, and honestly, there's the horror that we see online with these videos and in your hometown, but you can't help but be a human and think, okay, this is the stuff we see. You cannot capture on your phone when a doctor doesn't believe that a Black woman right. is in pain. Right. You can't capture on a phone when someone doesn't get a job or when someone's, you know, delivery of their birth like goes wrong because they aren't believing them. And so there's the horror of seeing it. And then there's the horror of knowing that, you know, there's a lot of things we can't capture on camera as well. So I'm trying very hard to, you know, not let gender and race make me talk about my hope, because honestly, thinking about what's wrong drives me to act. And so I'd rather just stick out where the truth is and let that drive me. Yeah.
I love that response. And I can't wait to see what comes next. And Kylie, thank you so much.
This was really nice.
Just for your honesty is amazing, and it's refreshing. And this book, I do think it's a balm, and not in the way that you would expect. In a weird way, okay. It kind of hit me in all the spots I needed to be hidden during a lockdown. So thank you
so
for that.
Glad. Yeah, this was really, really lovely. Thank you so much. Every time I get the privilege of having a Black interviewer, I like forget myself and I'm like, oh, we're recording. Like, just like, be cool. So this was really, really nice. I really appreciate it.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Root Presents It's Lit is produced by myself, Maisha Kai, and Michaela Heck. Our sound engineer is Ryan Allen. Our theme song was penned by yours truly and producer Scott Jacoby. If you like the show and want to help us out, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. It really, really helps us out, and we appreciate your feedback so much. If you have any thoughts or feedback, you could find me on Twitter at Maisha, that's M-A-I-Y-S as in Sam, H-A, and at Maisha Kai on Instagram. And before we go, we always like to talk a little bit about what we're currently reading. What I'm currently reading now is The Personal Librarian. Now, this is a novel based on a true story, kind of a turn of the century story, turn of the last century, that is, of a woman who was hired by J.P. Morgan to run his library and curate a collection of rare manuscripts. And she happens to be passing. Now, if you listen to the podcast, you know I tend to be kind of intrigued by these particular stories and how people navigated this very dangerous precipice of identity. So this is a book I'm really excited to be digging into, and I was looking forward to since I heard about this true story that it's based on. But we will get into that more later and hopefully in detail with the writer. But that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week. And in the meantime, you know what to do. Keep it lit.